Welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, California's historic segregation of Mexican Americans contrasted with the South's version of segregation. In California, who did this segregation serve? Our next guest says it was the interests of citrus capitalism in Orange County. And first, in the 1960s and 1970s, a group of Black filmmakers at UCLA used techniques they learned to make great films to challenge Hollywood. The LA Rebellion presented films with uniquely Black stories. What was this movement, and what did it accomplish? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Hollywood has a mixed, if not downright dreadful, record on representations of Black communities. From the recognition of certain acceptable Black roles in films, what comes to mind are things like the Oscar wins for Driving Miss Daisy and Green Book, to the invisibility of so many Black experiences, cinema has marginalized this community of color. But Black filmmakers have sought to change this, taking control of their own narratives. Usually from outside the major studios, independent filmmakers have used their tools, their techniques to challenge Hollywood. And UCLA, starting in the late 1960s, going into the 1980s, saw the development of Black film that has been known by many different names, but the most common name and the one we're going to use today is the LA Rebellion. So to celebrate Black History Month, we explore the LA Rebellion. Where did it come from? What was its message? And what has been its impact on film today? Our panel today is Allison Nadia Field. She's Associate Professor of Cinema and Media Studies at the University of Chicago. She's the author of Uplift Cinema, The Emergence of African American Film and the Possibility of Black Modernity, and the co-editor of LA Rebellion, Creating a New Black Cinema. And Bernard Nicholas, he's writer and director of films, including documentaries and short videos, and was part of the LA Rebellion, and the director of Daydream Therapy, Boat People, and Gidget Meets Hondo. Thank you both so much for joining us. Allison, let's start with a most basic question. What was the LA Rebellion? What was it trying to accomplish?
Well, thank you so much for having us. We're really excited to talk about this incredible group of filmmakers with you. The LA Rebellion is a term that was applied retrospectively by Clyde Taylor to a group of filmmakers that came out of UCLA in the 70s and 80s, who began as students in the late 1960s, who came to UCLA. Many were recruited by programs on the GI Bill or programs for underrepresented minorities to congregate at UCLA and join the film school in an effort to both increase diversity on campus, but also to address the kind of wider problems that society was feeling in the late 60s. And so a group of filmmakers started a school at UCLA in the film school, and slowly more students were admitted of color, and they were given access to equipment, encouraged to go out into the communities and film their own neighborhoods and their own communities, tell stories from their own experiences. And what they found is both the access to equipment and the education that had so far really been only afforded to white affluent students. And then they found a community. And so they were able to work with each other, crewed on one another's films, and kind of develop this corpus of films that really reflected that collaborative engagement, but also reflected their own lived experiences.
And Bernard, why UCLA? What was, part of your story, and how did you find yourself at UCLA, and how much was the presence of these other filmmakers a motivation to go to UCLA?
I attended UCLA as an undergrad as well. And towards the end of my undergrad studies, I happened to take a class from Alessio Taylor. And he was a great inspiration in that he was the first person to bring courses on third world cinema to UCLA. And so I really enjoyed that class and learned a great deal about what filmmakers were doing all over the world, in a kind of cinema that was the opposite of Hollywood. And then I didn't think about it again. And much later, when I had obtained my bachelor's degree in economics and I was working a really bad job delivering bad water, and I was thinking, you know, maybe I should just go back to graduate school. And I went back to graduate school in Latin American studies. And then I had a conversation with Barbara McCullough, who was one of the other LA Rebellion Black filmmakers. And she told me that, you know, you don't have to have a film background to apply to the film school. So it occurred to me, maybe I should apply. And so it did make a big difference that there were a group of people, all of whom had been somewhat inspired by Elizio Taylor's efforts, who were there. And so that and certainly made it comfortable for me to apply because I knew that I was going to be with a group of people. And just to add one other thing about UCLA, although UCLA did a tremendous service to the LA Black Rebellion by obtaining the grants that made this book possible, and the efforts of all the editors of the books, which have really brought tremendous attention to these films, it's important to realize that back in the early 70s, this was not being done voluntarily by UCLA. It was part of a long history of struggle by students and some faculty members to try to have some diversity at the university. And since I mentioned that I was an economics major at one point, the chair of the Department of Economics when I was an undergraduate had written the text for Economics 101. And in his textbook, he had written that capitalism is about the allocation of scarce resources, which implies competition and discrimination. And when students came to his office to talk to him about having more people of color on the department, he brandished a shotgun and chased them out. So that was the context from which all the struggles came from.
Yeah, I think it's really important to note that UCLA was a really a hotbed of a lot of activism at the time. This is the period of Angela Davis. This is the period of anti-Vietnam protests. At the same time, UCLA was incredibly affordable. So for something like $25 a class, students could enroll. And so it was much more accessible than it is now, than most institutions of higher education are now. And so students were able to have access to the resources of the film department and the campus.
I think that's a great point. The importance of diversity as well as socioeconomic diversity to be able to tell these stories. Now, Allison, Bernard had mentioned some of the first instances of third world film being shown in, you know, in classes. And of course, if this is the late 60s, this is a decade of decolonization, a lot of new countries. So how much was that driving it? And then how much was the LA Rebellion also being driven by the fact that black representation in Hollywood films was, shall we say, problematic?
Yeah, all of these things were important. So, this is a time when the film instructors like Elizio Taylor, like Tishomi Gabriel, were showing films from around the world, in addition to European avant-garde, like Italian neorealism, which was very influential in a lot of the filmmakers, documentaries. They're looking at African cinema, they're looking at world cinema, they're looking at new Latin American filmmaking, they're looking at politically engaged filmmaking and other contexts of struggle. And so they're looking at models for how film can be a tool of political liberation. And that certainly shows up in the films that were produced in very different ways by LA Rebellion filmmakers. And they're also looking at American independent film and other kinds of alternatives to Hollywood, whether it's Oscar Michaud and the history of race film to independent cinema. And of course, they're being schooled in the industry itself. And I think it's important to note that not all filmmakers that we understand as part of the LA Rebellion were hostile to Hollywood. Some actually actively sought opportunities to work in the industry. Some saw themselves as commercial filmmakers that wanted to make entertaining films. But most, and Bernard can corroborate this, I think we're really invested in learning the master's tools to dismantle the master's house, to find alternative forms of storytelling, cinematic storytelling, that escaped and w went against the kind of constrictions on Black representation that were coming out of Hollywood. So all of these things were, whether it was the Black aesthetic traditions, whether it was the kind of political climates of the time and the kind of literature and political philosophies that they were reading, but all of this was influencing the kinds of films that they were making.
So, Bernard, how much of this then did you see this in you and your classmates? And I know you can only speak for yourself, but if you have any insights into others who are part of the rebellion, did you see this as a means to try to create an alternative narrative that was meant to challenge Hollywood? And how much was it, we want to move Hollywood? The recognition of, independent film is important, but independent voices making their way into the mainstream.
Well, to put things kind of in context, it's important for those who may not know to point out that in the early 70s, you could count the number of Black filmmakers who were working on major Hollywood films on one hand. We had had the so-called Black exploitation era. Most of the directors of those films were white filmmakers, and there was a reason why they were called Black exploitation. So it wasn't only that we were anti-Hollywood, but it was not even a consideration that it was realistic to think about breaking into Hollywood. And I mentioned this in an interview that's in the book about the LA Black Rebellion, but I distinctly recall talking to a professor at the film school early on when I was either when I was admitted or when I was being interviewed for admission. And he pointed out that when you get a master's degree in film production, not only will that not get you a job in Hollywood, it might actually work against you because they don't want people with a bunch of smart ideas. So, there was that. And then there was also the fact that part of the whole third cinema movement was recognizing how much American films have been a part of the oppression of people all over the world, and how much racism and exploitation had been embedded in American cinema. So we had good reasons to be against that tradition.
I think the other important thing to think here is that, as Bernard noted, the industry wasn't entirely welcoming to film students in general, but certainly not film students of color. So some of the filmmakers talked about how their white classmates graduated into the industry and they graduated into a desert. There were foreclosed opportunities, lack of access primarily to capital to make films. And of course, a desire not to work in a compromised industry and not to make the kinds of films that the industry wanted of them and to represent a kind of blackness as represented by the industry. And that even though many filmmakers received critical and festival acclaim for their work, that doesn't always translate to open doors into historically what was an old boys network. What I do think is important, because we have Bernard here, is to point out the kind of ingenuity that a lot of these filmmakers had in solving kind of these problems of access. And so for Bernard, what he did is he set up a distribution network. He turned into a distributor in order, well, Bernard can talk about what he did, because I think this is an important piece of the story that gets undertold, that it's not just about making films and producing films, but it's also about creating the conditions of access to films for a broader audience.
And you listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. Today's topic, the LA Rebellion, a group of Black filmmakers starting in the 60s through the 80s, challenging Hollywood and making their own narratives. Our guests today are Allison Nadia Field, she's from the University of Chicago, and Bernard Nicholas, who's a writer and director of films and was part of the LA Rebellion. I do want to go to the and talk about the distribution, but I want to make sure we give ourselves enough time to actually talk about some of these different films. What's the content of some of these films? And Bernard, one of them that the book references, pretty regularly, I'd love you to describe. You have one called Gidget Meets Hondo. What was that film?
That film was my project two in film school. And project one was the very first film you make before you know anything about exactly how to make films. So Project Two was one where I've learned a little bit about how you're supposed to make the film. So I chose as a topic a satirical conflict between the Gidget stereotype from many Hollywood movies, and then another stereotype from a television show that had just emerged a few years before, which was the SWAT television show. And the captain of the SWAT team was named Hondo. So in the film, Gidget is living in her expensive condo in Marina Del Rey, ignoring a police shootout going on TV. And then Hondo is looking for terrorists and he breaks into her apartment. He has the wrong address and he ends up killing her. And the message is that you can be clueless and still get killed.
Which resonates today.
Yes.
Sadly, and Allison, do you have a couple of films representations that you think particularly, the listeners would say, I want to experience these LA Rebellion films. These are the ones maybe they should try to track down.
One of the things that I think so remarkable about this body of work is how diverse it is. And so I will say that it's hard to find a representative example because there's such breadth across the work. People who have not encountered Charles Burnett's Killer of Sheep, for example, I think that's a masterpiece. It's on the National Film Registry. Charles Burnett was given an honorary Oscar a few years back. This is an incredible portrait of a family on the south side of South Central Los Angeles and a kind of very soft, neorealistic black and white film that really invites the spectator to live with this family and feel what they're feeling, go through the kind of day-to-day struggles as they do. And it's incredibly moving. So I recommend that entirely. For folks who are interested in more overtly political films that are a little more combative, the body of work by filmmaker Haile Gerima, who's an Ethiopian filmmaker based in the United States, his films are tremendous. So Bush Mama is one film that he did about a black welfare recipient in Los Angeles who's being pressured by the welfare office to get an abortion. And at the same time, her partner gets incarcerated. And it's about the kind of oppressiveness of the police state on Black women, on Black families, and relationships. I think it's incredibly powerful and very important, and sadly also quite resonant today. And then a very different tone would be another masterpiece, Julie Dash's Daughters of the Dust, which is in gorgeous color. is lusciously shot in the South Sea Islands. And it's a period piece about the last moments before a family migrates to the North from the South. And it's a stunning work of American cinema. So those three are kind of at the top of my list. I'd be curious what Bernard's list would be.
Bernard, would you like to add to that list?
I don't have a list, but I would certainly support what you said, which was there was a great diversity of topics. And besides talking a lot about politics, we were a group of artists, and so we were very supportive of each other. And we would have very intense political discussions and criticism about script ideas and things like that. And we still produced a great diversity of work. So I think the diversity is one of the most fascinating things about the LA Black Rebellion School.
But it
Sure.
really ranges from experimental short films to commercial cinema. So there's really something for everybody in this body of work.
Now, Bernard, Allison suggested, one of the biggest challenges, you're making these films, and anybody familiar with the film industry knows that there can be a huge gap between the making of the films and the quality of those films, and then finding distribution and actually finding a way so that people can actually see those. She had mentioned that you started working on distribution. First of all, how much success do you think you had with that? And what were some of the huge challenges at trying to find places where you can actually show these wonderful films?
Well, to put it in context again, well, of course, it takes a long time to complete a film. And even a short film, there's a lot of struggle to complete it. And you finally get to the point where you have a print. And of course, you have to use some of your lunch money saved to make the print. And then when you are invited to participate in a festival, you have to find money to ship the print to someone. And the print was fairly heavy compared to a DVD. So there were rare opportunities to actually show your films. And whenever there was a gathering of filmmakers, the discussion would turn to the idea that distribution is a problem. So I really grew tired of hearing and talking about it and got to the point where I decided I wanted to do something about it. And VHS had emerged as a dominant form of video distribution. So in the early 1990s, I decided that I would take the opportunity to try to distribute films on VHS. And I did a business plan, got some people to put some money up, and my business plan called for $250,000 of capital. But I was only able to raise $35,000. And I decided to start anyway. And I wanted to make it a very professional and presentable distribution mechanism. So I invested in creating a computer animation logo and in finding ways of getting the films out as broadly as possible. And I was the first person that I was able to sign a deal with is Alile Sharon Larkin, and two of her films, one of which was a children's film. That was the very first one that we distributed. And it was actually more successful than I expected, on one hand, in the sense that I was able to get the films into large retailers like Target. But then I was learning by doing. And I learned that, first of all, to get into Target, you had to go through a middleman. And you had to sell the videos to the middleman at something like 10, 15% of the actual retail price. And then I was all excited that I was getting into Target. Then I discovered that Target reserved the right to return any unsold product for complete refund. So even though I was able to stick a toe into the distribution business, I had to accept the fact that if Disney could discount videos down to a price of $8 for a VHS cassette, and I was selling them for $29.95 because I needed to do that just to even try to break even, then even some people who were conscious and might want to buy a black film for their child, they're likely to get the $8 video than the $30 one, you know. So I learned a lot. I was able to get four films out into distribution. You know, that followed independent distribution efforts that exist today that are able to do things on streaming, like Quailee TV and things like that, which weren't accessible back then. But I'm glad that I made a good try at it, because it was a chance to learn a lot and to kind of do something rather than simply talk about how tough it was to get films distributed.
Distribution is still a challenge, though fortunately we have more and more platforms for it today. So it's maybe a little bit easier than having to try to sell VHS tapes, but it's still a challenge. Allison, where do you see the greatest impact in cinema today from filmmakers like LA Rebellion?
It's so hard to answer that question because I think the impact really is so deeply personal and individual to the audience members who encounter these films. These are films that have deep, deep resonance across various communities. They show an aspect of Black life that had been denied on the American screen for much of the history of American cinema. And so the impact has been incredibly profound for spectators. I think the where it's difficult is exactly these kind of questions about breadth and reaching a wide audience and competing with the hegemony of Hollywood. At the same time, I think in the last, 10 years or so, we've seen an incredible broadening out of interest in these filmmakers, thanks in a large part to the LA Rebellion Project of UCLA and the UCLA Film and Television Archive. But more and more films are getting on the National Film Registry. As I said, Charles Burnett got an honorary Oscar. Beyoncé paid homage to Julie Dasch in with her Lemonade project. And so these are filmmakers who are also gaining more and more attention and a broader audience. But the biggest influence, I think, really is on contemporary filmmakers who grew up in film schools or watching these films and translate that, I think, into their work that is on all these platforms, that is streaming, that is in the megaplex. And so there's a kind of way that these films have also infiltrated into, I think, the consciousness about American independent filmmaking very broadly, but also, of course, the Black image in cinema.
Bernard, I'm going to give you the last word with that same question. When you see films today, where do you see some of the biggest impact that you and your fellow classmates, fellow members of LA Rebellion have had, the impact you've all had?
Well, let me answer it from a personal point of view. My first film that I had done way back in 1977, shot on Super 8, was Daydream Therapy. And it had shown at a few festivals and won a couple of awards. And then it ended up on the shelf for 40 years. And it was a few years before the Archives LA Rebellion Project was launched that I realized, why am I keeping all this stuff? And I started throwing away materials. And I had made a DVD master of my Daydream Therapy film. So I threw away the negative, where there was no negative, it was Super 8, but I threw away the sound master and stuff like that. And so I was ready to move on and had gone back to school to start a different kind of career. After the LA Rebellion Project was launched, and all of our films got a tremendous amount of exposure in the US and throughout the world, I've had several people tell me that seeing Daydream Therapy is the film that influenced me to be involved in a filmmaking career. And it was heartwarming to me to hear that from two or three people. So we can have kind of scholarly discussions about the impact of some of those films. And I'm very humbled by a lot of the fantastic things that have been written about Daydream Therapy in the book LA Black Rebellion. It's unbelievable to me to be compared to my idols like Ousmane Sembène. I never would have thought to compare my work with his. I guess history will judge what the impact was, but many filmmakers have acknowledged that their first exposure to independent Black cinema were from the films of the LA Black Rebellion.
The LA Black Rebellion, what a wonderful cinematic movement. I think the work of this project to remind us all of its historic importance. And I hope everybody who's listening gives the greatest respect and the greatest homage to these films. Our guests have been Alison Nadia Field. She's an associate professor of cinema and media studies at the University of Chicago, the author of Uplift Cinema, The Emergence of African American Film and the Possibility of Black Modernity, and very salient to today's conversation, the co-editor of LA Rebellion, Creating a New Black Cinema. And Bernard Nicholas, he's a writer, director of films, including documentaries and short videos, three of them, Daydream Therapy, Boat People, and Gidget Meets Hondo. Thank you so much for sharing your time, your expertise, and in particular, Bernard, thank you so much for making some great films.
Well, thank you for having this show. It was a pleasure to participate.
Thank you so much.
When we come back, Segregation in America was not limited to the Old South and against African Americans. In Southern California, citrus planters segregated Mexican Americans. What happened and why? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. The famous Supreme Court case, Brown versus Board of Education, challenged segregation in public schools. But there was another precedent, the Mendez et al. Case, that challenged segregation in education in California against Mexican Americans. What brought that case and what happened? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Most conversations about segregation focus on the color bar and Jim Crow laws discriminating against African Americans in the United States. But segregation extended beyond black-white issues, and it was not restricted to the old Confederacy. Mexican Americans faced segregation as well, and the patterns in some ways mirrored anti-black segregation, but they actually had some quite unique characteristics. And it was not restricted to the old Confederacy. In fact, there was quite a bit centered around Orange County here in Southern California and served the interests of what our author calls citrus capitalism. So in this segment, we're going to explain the historic practice, the practice of segregation against Mexican Americans in Southern California with the author of a new book on this topic. David James, or DJ Gonzalez, is assistant professor of history at Brigham Young University. He's the author of the book we are discussing today. This is titled Breaking Down the Walls of Segregation: Mexican American Grassroots Politics and Civil Rights in Orange County, California. He's also the host of a podcast, New Books in Latino Studies. Professor Gonzalez, DJ, thank you so much for joining us. My first question, what was the nature of segregation in Southern California? In the intro, I said in some ways it mirrored what was going on in the South, in some ways it was different. So in what ways was it the same, and in what ways was it different?
Well, Doug, thanks for having me. It's great to be here. And that's a phenomenal question. And it's one that pulled me in more and more into this topic. I'll begin by answering that question by discussing briefly how I discovered segregation and how it was so systemic in Orange County. Going through my undergraduate education, I read a lot of books and eventually graduate education about that had mentioned the word segregated with Mexicans and other groups in California, but it was always very spotty, and it was kind of a taken for granted. We have these things called barrios or urban neighborhoods, so a lot of times it was framed to me in a post-war kind of white flight, growth of the suburbs kind of narrative. And when I got studying this project and really the case that we'll eventually talk about, that comes from all of this, I wanted to understand that question. How and why did Orange County become so segregated? Because as I started my research, I was looking through the 1930 census. And the 1930 census is crucial because in that year, the Census Bureau added a category, Mexican. And it was literally to count all the Mexican people that had essentially come over the prior 20 years during the Mexican Revolution. And so as I was going through the census and literally page by page, these are manuscript, pages that were digitized, and they have all these categories. And I started taking this data and putting it into spreadsheets, and I started noticing something very troubling. And that was that for, multiple enumeration districts, there were no Mexicans. They and one could say, okay, well, Mexicans were a minority. There weren't a lot of Mexicans in Orange County. Okay, and they were a minority. But as I later found, they were quite a sizable minority. They were roughly anywhere from 15 to 20% of Orange County in by 1930. So that's quite a lot. You're going to notice it. What I did notice also was that as whenever I found a Mexican, when I finally hit that Spanish language name and that would be, associated with the Mexican racial category, the number of Mexicans then increased rapidly and the number of white people dropped rapidly. And so, and I saw this, one enumeration district to another, from city to city, from, Anaheim, to Santa Ana, to Yorba Linda, you name it, anywhere in Orange County, this was became very, very predictable. And so then the question is, okay, I'm seeing and documenting segregation, and it's systemic. It's happening all throughout the county. Okay, and you can record it now, and I have it recorded quantitatively. Then the question is, why? Why did it happen? And I thought, okay, well, what do I know about, urban history? Okay, I'm going to start looking at segregationist codes and segregationist statutes, like what existed in the Jim Crow South. Well, throughout Southern California and California broadly, explicitly segregationist codes, either at the municipal level or the state level, weren't widely used. There may be some cases here and there, but there weren't segregationist codes or statutes that reserved this quarter of the city or this neighborhood for Mexicans. And so it became much more trying, a much more difficult task of trying to, figure out why and how. And so then I looked into, really, well, what are all these Mexicans doing for work? Okay, and they were doing a lot of things, wage labor, but a lot of them worked for the citrus industry. And as I looked at where these neighborhoods were located, they were located adjacent to a citrus grove, or maybe a walnut, grove, a train track, a packing house, all these kind of industrial markers of the citrus industry. And I came to learn that, Orange County, the citrus economy, that's what drove it. These citrus capitalists, these people that came in the late 1880s-ish, around there. And they bought really good land. Then they had land. They had investments from other places, people like Charles C. Chapman, of Orange, who was a book publisher, had a lot of land in Chicago, sold that stuff, came to Orange County, became a citrus farmer, if you will, but did so as an investment. And they built a very hierarchical industry through grower associations. People would recognize this as Sunkist. Sunkist is the brand that the California Fruit Growers Association ex Exchange developed. And these people, right, these farmers that formed these growers associations, they controlled everything. They controlled the land, they controlled the banks, they controlled the water districts, they controlled the school boards, right, the county board of supervisors. So I came to understand that Orange County was run like a company town. And so they didn't need to use segregationist statutes. They, were able to, change land use through zoning and this of that, and create a private subdivision here for Mexicans only, for Mexican workers. They're able to, they built grower provided housing on citrus groves themselves, so company provided housing. And as much as it didn't use these codes, it was very predictable. You could see it, you could measure it, you could predict where it was going to happen. And all in all, by the 1930s, Orange County had roughly about 53 or so segregated neighborhoods, full of Mexicans, called, we refer to these as barrios and colonias. A barrio is a more urban, segregated neighborhood, and usually was like an older part of town that had another demographic in the past, like maybe, Eastern European, right, ethnic European laborers or other folk. And then you had colonias, which were more rural villages that were much closer to the, citrus groves and things of that sort. So the ways in that it looks familiar is that, okay, you have a race-based economic system, labor system. This is, whether you go to Jim Crow or you go to slavery, I mean, that's what it is, an economic system that's exploiting people, by race and ethnicity for, profit. So those were some similarities, but the key differences is there's no use of really municipal or state statutes. It was illegal to segregate Mexicans. Really, at this time in Orange County, you could segregate Native Americans and Asians in different to different schools, but you couldn't do that with Mexicans. The code didn't allow you to do it. They did it anyways, the point is, and they did it through business practices that sought to attract and preserve not just Mexican male laborers, but Mexican families. They wanted to bring families because they would have generations of laborers then. And so that's how, in Orange County, it starts to have, both a similar look, in regards to its connected residential segregation, connected to labor exploitation. But it's different in that, these people didn't come to Orange County automatically thinking we're going to segregate a bunch of workers. A series of pressures, primarily World War I and immigration restriction in the 1910s and 19 teens, lead citrus capitalists to determine that Mexican families are their key to preserving and controlling their labor situation. And if they could attract them with neighborhoods, then they could hold on to them. And that could at least solve, one of the most complicated parts of the equation, which is, consistent, and predictable labor costs, because the grower associations ran everything. The farmer that owned the land, he didn't choose who picked his crop. He was a member of a grower association, and the grower association, would pick, do the picking schedules, hire the laborers through foremans, get everything shipped and packed, arrange everything with the, railroads and the marketing strategies. All of that was handled by the grower association. And so it was these grower associations, the citrus capitalists that ran them, that created this system for profitability, not because they were just inherently racist. A lot of these people were racist, but they weren't trying to segregate for segregation. For, for a kind of racist purpose. It was really for profit.
So the segregation itself, the interest that it's serving is to be able to provide cheap labor, not terribly much competition for that labor, consistent labor, et cetera. Was the segregation something because the growers, because the capitalists are providing the housing, therefore kind of naturally segregated, or was there an explicit intentionality to separate communities? How much intentionality was there attached to the segregation?
That was my question too, because it seemed to me, again, when I looked at the scale of this is intentional. How do we explain it, and how do we prove it? And so there's three primary ways that the housing developed. The first was through grower-provided housing. So a lot of this segregation developed from massive orange groves or ranches that they would, as they would call them, and they would build various types of housing on there. And that housing, and this is all promoted through the industry's major industrial publication, that is the California Citrograph, which was, had an extensive readership. And they're the ones that would promote, building housing in order to attract workers. And that housing was segregated. They would keep Asians away from Mexicans and white workers away from both of them, and they would give the best housing to, the either it was the supervisors or people that worked in the packing house. They would kind of have these little house cottages, right? And then, the more bunk type labor was always for Mexican males initially, or Chinese workers at one point. Again, eventually immigration restriction cut off access to Asian labor and Southern Eastern European labor, particularly during World War I. So that started the model of it, segregating grower provided housing. And then when they really needed to up the scale, right, in order to get a lot more housing, they built private subdivisions. So either the growers themselves owned the land, or they knew someone that owned the land that was adjacent to their packing house or their grove, and they would make arrangements with them. Say, hey, we need a place for these workers to live. And the person say, no problem, let's subdivide, this plot of land. And they would sell only to Mexican laborers. It was exclusive. And this was in the newspaper. You can find this in the Santa Ana Register, the Anaheim Bulletin. They had these advertisements, even advertisements for a sales agent, right, that would, go and then go out and find the Mexicans to live there. And so a lot of that rapid growth came from those colonias, come from those private subdivisions. And then the third type was more of the urban kind of neighborhoods that, through kind of like ethnic and demographic change, became almost predominantly Mexican, and particularly the ones that were closely, that were close to, again, a packing house, or a railroad track. Over time, as the number of labor was needed for that city, they became predominantly Mexican.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're talking about the history of segregation in Orange County in Southern California. Our guest has written a new book on this. It's David James or DJ Gonzalez. He is at Brigham Young University. And the title of the book is Breaking Down the Walls of Segregation, Mexican American Grassroots Politics and Civil Rights in Orange County, California. So we've kind of laid out how segregation, had developed, but there was resistance to the segregation. There were definitely ways in which the Mexican American community had tried to fight back. The first, and I found this really fascinating within the book, is the Mendez case. You had drawn parallels between Mendez and maybe the most famous anti-segregation case, Brown versus Board of Education. First of all, what was the Mendez case? What was that based on? And what was the ruling? What was the significance of this case?
So, emanating from the residential segregation that was tied to the labor exploitation of Mexicans and Mexican families. By 1933, there were 15 exclusively 100% Mexican schools throughout 44 school districts in Orange County. Only 11 of the 44 school districts actually had a separate Mexican school, and that was because of funding. Orange County didn't have a ton of money necessarily, that is in its public coffers, to build, all these segregated schools. And so when the demands became necessary and there were enough parents and teachers complaining about it and school administrators, they would finally build a brand new school for white kids and leave the Mexicans in the old school. For those, and so about 65% of ethnic Mexicans, that is Mexican Americans, American-born children primarily, these are in the Mexican schools. 65% of them were in a 100% fully segregated Mexican school. The remainder were in so-called integrated schools throughout the county, but they were usually segregated within the school into separate classrooms. So segregation, whether it was within the school or outside the school, was just the norm. And so the Mendez case is filed in 1945. Now, parents had started fighting as early as 1912. There's a group of citizens, Mexicans in Santa Ana, that formed a club called the Pro Patria Club. And they went before the Santa Ana School Board when the Santa Ana School Board started proposing building a separate Mexican school. This was in 1912. And when they started, I think 1919 is when the group went before the school board. So they had tried to push back against this for a while. School boards had ignored this, right, and built the schools anyways and segregated the Mexicans anyways. So the book details, right, a series of grassroots movements that lead up to the Mendez case, where you have five plaintiff families file a class action lawsuit on behalf of 5,000 Mexican children throughout the whole county. It is the first class action loss desegregation school lawsuit at the federal level, the first one of its kind. The judge, John McCormick, he noted this. And when in the pretrial hearing, when they were trying to, when counsel's trying to figure out, well, how are we going to handle this case? Because eventually he's getting a picture like, oh my gosh, this is really big. This is systemic. There's no way we're going to haul representatives from every fifth, all 15 schools or these other schools. This is just going to take forever. And so Paul McCormick says, okay, this is a unique case. It's sui generis. We need to do a class action. This should be, handle this by a class action suit. Well, I'll go back and say that the attorney, David Marcus, is the one that had identified multiple plaintiff families and filed it as a class action. Again, in pretrial proceedings, they're trying to figure out which school districts are going to be sued. And they end up choosing four school districts, Westminster, Garden Grove, Santa Ana, and El Medina. And they choose those districts because each are representative of the type of segregation that was eventually identified as being used in other forms. And so the plaintiff families, the five plaintiff families in this class action lawsuit, basically sued and said there's like a conspiracy. These school districts are all in league with each other, right, to promote segregation throughout the county. And so it was eventually bargained that these five families, each one represented, two of them represented claims against Santa Ana, the other families against the other school districts, Westminster, Garden Grove, and El Medina. So the first class action lawsuit is the point of its kind in a desegregation case for any ethnic or racial group in American history. It's the first class action lawsuit at the federal level. And that's what really made it so significant, because Mexicans and other groups had been fighting segregation and filing cases. One of the earliest ones is in Alamosa, Colorado, for Mexicans in 1914, but it was very local and it didn't get up to the federal level. This was filed at the federal level, federal district court in Los Angeles. And so it's why it caught a lot of attention. And because, again, the size, the class action nature of it.
Yeah, and what was the resolution?
The resolution, so the class action case was filed in March of 1945. In February of 1946, the district court judge, Paul McCormick, finds in favor of the plaintiff families and says that even though initially in the court proceedings they're saying this is really not about race, because Mexicans are supposedly white, they have a legal claim to whiteness based on naturalization law and racially prerequisite cases, he realized, like, no, this was discriminatory segregation based on ethnicity and race, and found in favor of the plaintiff families and ordered the school districts to desegregate. Now, the school districts appealed, and this is what also made it very significant. So it went up to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and that appeal was eventually upheld in May of 1947. The other key to this case is all of this is happening, of course, in California when Earl Warren is the governor of California. He eventually becomes, right, named, he's named to the Supreme Court, and it's the Supreme Court Chief Justice when the Brown case is not initially filed. It was already filed with the Supreme Court. There's a death of a Chief Justice. He's the replacement. So he comes in having watched all this play out in California, the Mendez case be first ruled in favor of the plaintiffs and then upheld. And when it wasn't upheld, it was Earl Warren that, discussed with his attorney general and had them change the school code. So following the Mendez case being upheld on appeal in May of 1947, the California legislature changed the school code, removing its segregationist statutes, and thereby, by what I've been able to find, becomes the first state after like Reconstruction, to desegregate its school system as a result, again, of the Mendez case.
Yeah, and I think that's important to remember because frequently Brown gets described as sort of coming out of the ether, or Earl Warren came in and changed this, that the cases go from Plessy to Brown. And what you're reminding us, with this is there are definitely precedents, that there's definitely reasons why this direction towards desegregation, which may culminate in Brown, but there's a lot of precedents in this Mendez case is an important precedent. Now, there were different groups that were fighting. You had mentioned this, that had resisted segregation as far back as, I think you said 1910. Got a couple minutes left. I want to give you an opportunity to talk about what some of the most important of those groups were within the Mexican American community fighting against segregation.
What makes this story, as I argue, is so unprecedented is that in Orange County, in Southern California, in the 1930s, 1940s, there was no civil rights organization like the NAACP. And by the way, the NAACP, with James Carter and Thurgood Marshall, eventually they wrote an amicus brief in support of the Mendez case. So they knew what the Mendez case was coming, and they knew it was important, and that it had the potential to end segregation, before even what became Brown. But so Mexican grassroots organizations, like, and I start tracking them in the late 1920s, early 1930s, they start forming to fight discrimination, and they start just holding their own neighborhood meetings. And they start teaching each other how to lead, how to be civically engaged, how to appeal to our politicians. And they do this through several groups. One's called La Progresista Mexicana. That one's kind of a little bit more old school, built more from like immigrants. But they really had an anti-discriminatory focus that was beyond just like doing cultural celebrations and like a mutual benefit society in case someone died. They actually were organizing civically and responded to discriminatory treatment of Mexicans. Like there was a big flood in 1938, and it devastated Mexican communities in Atwood and La Jolla. These are little colonias up northeast of of Anaheim. And so they organized the community to provide the services that they needed and to push back against the county board of supervisors that was racializing the land and saying, it was kind of Mexicans' fault, for various reasons. Another one was called the Mexican American Movement. This was made up of high school and then college students. And this comes out of the YMCA clubs that were all throughout Southern California. These YMCA clubs formed these little Mexican groups, and they promoted education and sports betterment and things of like that, like physical health. But they started holding these conferences together where they would talk about how they were treated throughout Southern California. And Orange County is one of the key spaces where the leaders from the Mexican American movement eventually form. I mean, the Mexican American movement, the way to think about it, is kind of like a precursor to the Chicano movement and the Chicano student movement, at least that portion of the movement. Many of them were articulating very same things, complaining against segregated schools, wanting Mexican teachers. And so those are two of the groups that eventually lead to the school desegregation movement itself. They're a group of community members and neighbors and families, people that I refer to as unheralded activists because they haven't gotten an attention in the past, as this case and other movements have been talked about. They formed community groups like the Latin American Voters League. And so you can hear, even within the title of that organization, that they were intending to impact politics. And really, the whole focus of that group was initially ending segregation. That led to others in Placentia. There are a bunch of veterans that gathered together to also fight segregation there. Eventually, these and other groups end up partnering with a bigger regional group called LULAC, or the League of United Latin American Citizens, that was really popular in Texas. It had a few chapters in Southern California. The key is that during the Mendez case, LULAC sent up some representatives to Orange County to learn about what was going on there, because Texas has been fighting segregation for a while, and they had a few favorable decisions, but hadn't been able to rid themselves of it. And so they took a lot of inspiration from these ethnic Mexican communities in Orange County. And so eventually, a lot of these groups, the Latin American Voters League of Voters and Citizens of Placentia, and like Unity Leagues that were focused, all created. All of them became LULAC chapters. They ended up joining LULAC in the middle when there was an appeal and in the aftermath. And they used that organization eventually to transition from ending school segregation, which is what they do, at least de jure by law, right? To electing people to school boards. That's immediately what they get into. School boards, city councils, mayoral elections, the first Mexicans get elected to all those bodies in the immediate aftermath, the first few years after the Mendez cases. Is both won in 1946 and upheld in 47.
The book is entitled Breaking Down the Walls of Segregation: Mexican American Grassroots Politics and Civil Rights in Orange County, California. We've been talking about the history of segregation against Mexican Americans in Southern California, the roots of that being found in citrus capitalism and the interests of an ownership class, particularly the citrus industry in Orange County. A reminder, it's called Orange County for a reason because of the role of citrus. And our guest today has been David James, or DJ Gonzalez. He's an assistant professor of history at Brigham Young University. This is an important history that is not as well known. And so I want to thank you so much for sharing what, by the way, is just kind of the tip of the iceberg for what is really a very rich and formative history of a period that's just, we need to know more about it. Thank you for sharing your time and expertise with us.
Thanks, Doug. It's been a pleasure.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producer is Ankina Agassian. Seb Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on at Scholar Circle, or me at Armudian, and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.